It's Friday, November 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump visits the White House and the Capitol.
It's just sort of a revolt of just people saying, I want to be an American, I don't want to be part of a global community. I want to be British, I don't want to be part of a global community.
The Brexit comparison with Donald Trump's win. Also ahead, Hillary Clinton's impact with women. And Donald Trump will have to deal with the women of NATO. Love, loyalty, and war. At the movies, that is. It's all on today's International Edition. Just 2 days after his stunning election victory, President-elect Donald Trump and his wife Melania Trump came to the White House Thursday, invited by President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. No press was allowed to film their arrival, but the president and president-elect gave brief statements to reporters in the Oval Office after the meeting. Despite a long history of animosity between Obama and Trump, both were gracious. Trump told reporters the meeting was supposed to last about 10 minutes, but it lasted 90, and he said it could have gone on even longer. The president campaigned exceptionally hard for his former Secretary of State and fellow Democrat Hillary Clinton. Obama often derided Trump as unfit to lead the country. Meanwhile, Trump for years questioned whether Mr. Obama was born in the United States before recently acknowledging his citizenship and says that he plans to undermine key Obama policies. Despite the bitter campaign, Obama pledged on Wednesday to cooperate with Trump's takeover. Donald Trump next made his first visit to the Capitol as president-elect to meet with Republican leaders and discuss his ambitious legislative to-do list for the early months of his administration. Trump strategized with House Speaker Paul Ryan, and on the other side of the Capitol, he conferred with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's the other man that he will rely on to shepherd his agenda through Congress. VOA's Chris Simpkins tells us more about the initial work to ensure the clean transfer of power, a bedrock principle of American democracy.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
The election is over, but in a deeply divided country, Donald Trump's defeat of Hillary Clinton came with an outpouring of raw opinions outside the White House.
The white nationalism that this man, Donald Trump, has inspired within my country?
Trump, I think he's an awesome guy. I think he's the American dream personified.
Washington, D.C., you're fired.
Following a bruising political contest, President-elect Donald Trump sought to pave the way for reuniting the country.
We owe her a major debt of gratitude for her service to our country. I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
In defeat, Hillary Clinton offered to work with Trump to end partisan divides as part of the transition.
Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it.
Now the Obama administration will work together with Trump's transition team to hire government personnel, including selecting a new cabinet to run the country. President Obama offered his cooperation to ensure the peaceful transfer of power.
We are now all rooting for his success in uniting and leading the country. The peaceful transition of power is one of the hallmarks of our democracy. And over the next few months, we are going to show that to the world.
Before the election, Trump had refused to say whether he would accept the results, casting doubt on a smooth transition. Political analyst Norman Eisen with the Brookings Institution in Washington says President-elect Trump needs to deliver unifying messages before he takes office.
The speech that he gave last night was all he can do as a first step to send a sense of continuity, of acceptance, of bipartisanship.
I love this country.
The presidential transition process culminates January 20th with the ceremonial inauguration marking the beginning of the Trump presidency. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
And there's quite a lot for us to follow. Before then, you can check it all out at our website, voanews.com. But right now, we're checking out the pulse of social media. To do that, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in the studio with me. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, this was a big day for President-elect Donald Trump. What's the buzz on the web?
He had an action-packed day, of course. CNN reporter Manu Raju sent out this tweet Thursday. Trump has a very busy day today, meeting with President Barack Obama at 11 a.m., followed by House Speaker Paul Ryan at 12:30 p.m., and now Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at 1:30 p.m. Trump met with the outgoing POTUS, as with the tradition.
Well, what's the online reaction like?
Some people are sharing photos of Trump's previous visit to the White House. There are two photos of him shaking hands with former President Ronald Reagan. As for today's visit, Bloomberg national reporter Jennifer Jacobs sent out this tweet. Details from Trump/Obama meeting. Obama said, if he succeeds, the country succeeds. Trump called Obama a very fine man. So that's the positive side of today's meeting. But on the other side, Twitter users are taking note of the transition. And a comedian named Moshe Kasher shared this sarcastic tweet. It's important that we show President Trump and the Republicans the same respect and cooperation they showed President Obama. Many Democrats and some Republicans feel the GOP did not cooperate well with the country's first African-American president during his presidency.
But some of Trump's supporters must feel that he is not well received by the Democrats with all the protests that are going on.
Absolutely, all over the country. But let's just talk about the protests in New York, for example. Thousands of demonstrators took to the Trump Tower in Midtown with handmade signs, and they also use projectors to make letters appear on the Trump Tower. And New York Times features reporter Jacob Bernstein is a good person to follow because he posted pictures and videos from the protests, and his handle is at Bernstein Jacob. Some of the captions say that people are shouting, "We reject the president-elect," and of course a famous slogan, "Love Trump's hate."
Any other news?
Yeah, there are dynamic reactions from Democrats to Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who used to be one of the staunch critical officials to Donald Trump, and they expressed they will cooperate with President Trump. And while some people are saying they're disappointed, others are urging people not to blame the officials for working toward greater good. Jim, back to you.
All right. Thank you very much, G. You can follow all of the action on our program's Twitter account. It's at @VOA_IE. Myself and G also tweet out all the latest happenings with Donald Trump and everything else that's going on that we come across. I'm at VOA Stevenson. G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia. On North Korea, Donald Trump could change everything. Trump win fuels fears and celebrations in Australia. China produces more billionaires as its economy slows. World Bank fails to prevent worker abuse at its India tea estate. Vietnam scraps plans for its first nuclear power plants. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, take the news with you and follow it with our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Some analysts and Donald Trump himself have drawn the comparison between his surprise election victory and the earlier decision by British voters to leave the European Union.
At the ballot box on November 8th, we are going to do something so special. It'll be called Brexit plus plus plus.
International Edition's Ira Melman discusses this comparison with Professor Jim Hartley, chair of the Department of Economics at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts.
I think what both of these elections show is that both Britain and America are deeply divided. On the one side, in both countries, there's a set of what we can think of as the intellectual elites. They went to elite colleges, they work in education and media and government, and they have this very common worldview across the countries. They tend to talk of themselves as being global citizens or part of a global community. And on the other side, in both countries, we have what we can think of as the other America or the other Britain. And these are people whose primary loyalties are to family or community or, most importantly, nation. And I think what we saw in both elections, and you can see it in the campaign slogans, is a big clash between these two groups of people. The Trump campaign slogan of Make America Great Again. And so one set of Americans hear that and they say, yes, we want America to be great again. And on the other side, you had people saying, well, when was America ever great? Or why should America be great? And in Britain, we saw the slogan for the Brexit was, we want our country back. And this is an assertion that people want to be British and not European. And on the other side, people sneering and saying, well, why wouldn't you want to be a part of Europe? And I think what we have is this sort of intellectual elite just fundamentally do not understand the other sets of people out there. They look down on them. They tend to want to call them racists or fascists. And what we saw in the election is this whole set of people are just tired of that. They're just tired of being called fascists and racists. And they want their nation, and they're voting for vaguely nationalist appeals in both countries. And it's just sort of a revolt of just people saying, I want to be an American. I don't want to be part of a global community. I want to be British. I don't want to be part of a global community.
Economically speaking, is this dangerous to the countries that are entering this realm?
I don't know if it's dangerous or not. It's just that it's a different way of thinking about international economic relations. You saw it in both of them with things like international trade. International trade is a complicated issue. The economics of it are straightforward. As you do more and more international trade, it benefits both countries. It's unambiguous in the literature. But that's different than it benefits every single individual person. If I'm working in a factory and my factory closes down because of greater international trade, I'm out of a job and I'm not happy about it. And I may not like the appeal, well, it's good for the rest of us, or it's good for the whole world. You know, I just care that I lost my job. And I think, again, we have a whole set of people running countries that just haven't spent enough time learning how to talk to and listen to people that really did lose their jobs as these things happen. So the danger is we sort of, you know, throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, you lose all the ability of having international trade because we've been unable to articulate or talk about this with people who are affected adversely by it.
Well, you just referenced the fact that this is not limited to Great Britain and the United States. More and more is coming up, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think this sort of divide is going to be fairly common throughout the world, as this sort of set of people, this intellectual elite, really are transnational. They're in all the different countries. They meet, they have this common worldview. And what we can imagine is sort of increasing amounts of people in different country after country, you know, reasserting their nationhood. How it'll work out in elections going forward is hard to tell, because we don't know the relative percentages in all these countries. Part of the problem we have in all the polling data is for the people that you know, want to assert the primacy of nation. You know, if you say, I want to be American or I want to be British, people are going to call you a fascist, you might be reluctant to articulate that you really do care about your nation. And so the polling data on this gets really rough when we can't rely on people honestly revealing what they vote.
Professor Jim Hartley, he's the chair of the Department of Economics at Mount Holyoke College. Hillary Clinton's defeat was seen by some as a blow to feminism. Some American moms are wondering how to explain it to their young daughters. What exactly happened to the attempt to make female history? VOA's Carolyn Pursuti brings us that story from New York City.
You could see the anticipation in their eyes on election night. A Clinton win, proof that women are created equal. A belief shared by moms who brought their daughters with them to vote.
It's life-changing. I mean, my girls will always know that a girl can be president, so nobody needs to tell them that they can't do anything.
We can be the president. Yeah!
Hillary Clinton herself gave young girls like them encouragement in her concession speech.
Never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
So what happened? The gender difference is striking. According to Pew Research, men preferred Trump by 12%. CNN shows white women preferred Trump by 10%. David Schultz, a political science professor, spoke to us on Skype.
There's, I think, still a large percentage of our population that won't vote for a woman for president for the United States.
In the early 1900s, Elizabeth Cady Stanton fought for a women's right to vote. Colleen Jenkins is her descendant.
So she would ask, what's the next step?
Some Trump supporters suggest a different female presidential nominee.
No, I want a woman for a president. Yay! But I want her to have integrity.
As Clinton steps out of the picture, other women say they're ready to step in.
You know, we need to become active again in street politics, as I call it.
A century ago, women got the right to vote. Because of this election, they say they'll fight even harder to get the right to be in the White House. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, New York City.
When he takes office as president, Donald Trump will work shoulder to shoulder with leaders of NATO's top member states who happen to be women. During the campaign, Trump was accused of having a disrespectful attitude toward women. The concern adds to questions of whether he will sustain the U.S. commitment to defend members of the world's most powerful alliance. VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
Trump stunned the alliance and defense analysts when he told the New York Times the U.S. would defend NATO members against Russian aggression only if they paid their fair share in contributions to the alliance.
Donald Trump and what he represents with respect to NATO in particular is dangerous. He is going straight at the heart of the alliance, and even the idea of calling that into dispute, I think, terrifies a lot of particularly the Eastern European countries.
But analysts like Chung say it is not only his stance on NATO that gets the president-elect off to a shaky start with alliance members. His disrespectful remarks about women during the campaign could make for some awkward encounters with NATO's heavy hitters, including Britain's Theresa May and Germany's Angela Merkel.
I think that Mrs. May and Mrs. Merkel will be extremely professional and cordial. Having said that, it is difficult to imagine, as a woman, how one could overlook the things that he has said and the things that he has done.
But there is general agreement that Trump, May, and Merkel have one thing in common.
I think she's going to regard Donald Trump as a kind of United States phenomenon, in a way which just says this country, this extraordinarily rich and vital country, produces all kinds of ideas and people who are extraordinary in European terms.
What this extraordinary president-elect will mean for NATO will be seen in the months to come. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
And if you would like to check out video for many of these stories, just stop by our website at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film from Oscar-winning director Robert Zemeckis and starring Oscar nominee Brad Pitt and Academy Award winner Marion Cotillard, Allied, looks at the issues of love, loyalty, and war. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film, which opens November 23rd.
Said you were beautiful and good.
Being good at this kind of work is not very beautiful.
After the war, you have a place?
When the war is over, it won't matter where I am.
Brad Pitt plays Canadian Army officer Max Vatan, who goes undercover in Casablanca during World War II as part of a plan to assassinate a leading Nazi ambassador. That's where he encounters a French resistance fighter, Marianne Beauséjour, played by Oscar winner Marion Cotillard. They fall in love and later move to London and are married, but their life together is put in jeopardy when British officials say that Marianne could be a double agent.
There's no easy way to say what we're about to say.
We suspect your wife is a German spy.
It's insane.
If you are right, all this will be forgotten. But if she is,
you will execute her with your own hand, and if you do not comply, you'll be hanged.
Pitt says that the idea for the film came from writer Stephen Knight when the two worked together on World War Z.
The story itself, though, I learned about, I had a meeting with Stephen Knight, the writer.
Yep.
Years ago when we were shooting World War Z, and he began to tell me the story before he'd written it, and it was based on members of his family.
Cotillard says she was fascinated by playing such a strong, independent woman who is capable of both extreme violence and passionate love.
There's a truth and an authenticity about her. This movie is really a love story, and her love for this man is really authentic. It's a very strong character. She's a very strong woman, and it's always fun to play a very strong woman.
Director Robert Zemeckis says the movie touches on universal themes.
Well, it's kind of a universal theme. You know, life gets in the way of love a lot of times, and it's something that everybody can relate to.
This is Brad Pitt's fourth World War II-related film, following Inglourious Basterds in 2009, Beyond All Boundaries, and 2014's Fury. Director Robert Zemeckis says that both Pitt and Cotillard were great to work with.
Well, they turned out exactly as I hoped. They were, you know, both are fantastic actors, and I couldn't be more pleased, and I had a great time working with both of them. They're just wonderful.
The film was shot in 14 locations, including the Canary Islands, France, and around London. Allied is rated R for violence, sexuality, drug use, and profanity. The film opens in the United States November 23rd. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
For director Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You've been listening to International Edition. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
20 years after the United States and Vietnam normalized their relations, the two countries have steadily strengthened their cooperation. The bilateral relationship has never been stronger, cooperating on a full spectrum of issues, including education, science and technology, climate change, sustainability, public health, and security. Indeed, in May of this year, during a visit to Vietnam, President Barack Obama announced the lifting of the decades-old arms embargo. By doing so, President Obama removed the lingering vestiges of the Cold War and ensures that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself. This change also underscored the commitment of the United States to a fully normalized relationship with Vietnam, including strong defense ties with Vietnam and the region for the long term. Building upon the May 2016 visit of President Obama to Vietnam and the July 2015 visit of the Communist Party of Vietnam's General Secretary Nguyen Phu Trao to the United States, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry invited Dinh Thu Vinh, Executive Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam's Central Committee, to Washington to deepen engagement between the two governments. Secretary Kerry and Mr. Nguyen reiterated the two countries' commitment to deepening our comprehensive partnership, promoting trade and economic growth, and strengthening regional security and stability. Additionally, they discussed the peaceful management and resolution of disputes in the South China Sea, cooperating on humanitarian and disaster relief response, advancing human rights and legal reform, and collaborating on climate change mitigation and adaptation, particularly in the Mekong Delta. Both underscored their country's commitment to ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a free trade agreement that has the potential to shape the future of the region. "We both share a commitment to the peaceful use and respect for rule of law in the South China Sea," said Secretary of State Kerry during a joint press conference. "The people of Vietnam today are witnessing a remarkable economic revolution. They are engaged in an amazing economic endeavor, a capitalist endeavor. It's one of the fastest growing countries in the region. We very much look forward to a very productive relationship."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.